CliffCentral.com.
Yes. Notorious B.I.G. with Juicy. Love it. I'll never get sick of that guy. Easily one of the all-time greatest rappers. No contest. Has to be one of the best people that ever took to music, and we lost him too early. He had much more to give. Notorious B.I.G. All right, quick story for you before we get to the burning platform, and perhaps Canton and Pumi want to comment on this, but apparently people, for the most part, do get happier after 40. How's that for interesting? So if you think you're a miserable 20-something, you're Gen Z or millennial, and you're having a shitty time, there's good news for you. You could be happier after 40 than you are before you turn 40. How's that for interesting? And unexpectedly so. So this is according to The Economist. Life begins at 40, according to an old saying popularized by a self-help book from the 1930s. Mm-hmm. The theory goes that years of hard work are rewarded with less stress, better pay, and children who begin to fly the nest, and with some luck, a decent period of good health remains. A quick glance at the self-reported happiness across the world seems to corroborate this view. People in their teens and their early 20s start out reasonably cheerful, and then late in their life satisfaction on a scale of 0 to 10, they ask to fill in this form. This is from Gallup. The data reported by the authors of the World Happiness Report show that happiness among people across the world aged 15 to 19 was 5.35 out of 10. A slow depression then starts to set in. By 35 to 39, average self-reported happiness falls to 5.09. Once people hit 40, their depression gradually lifts.
Gareth, you are blinding us with numbers. Why? Why?
I know. Who cares? Facts don't care, right?
Okay.
It's because we're trying to convince Mbulelo that after 40, we're happier than he is.
Oh. Yes, because he's being an ageist.
He's been ageist all morning.
I heard that part. Yeah. My app was working fine, by the way, guys.
Thank you. I'm glad to hear that.
I just want to put that out there.
We did have some feedback.
Here's what's far more interesting, Gareth. Take a look at this. Here's the headline. Just read the headline.
Very right-wing people are happiest with their sex life. Very right-wing. Very right-wing would be what? Reactionaries.
They're often happiest overall, too, according to a five-country.
So no vaginismus in that area.
A five-country YouGov poll.
Well, can we... Let's start the burning platform. It's brought to you by Nando's. Every week we get together, and this morning our returning champions of Pumi Mashiho and Canton Pele. Canton, by the way, with his hair untied, he looks like an Indian Rapunzel.
I've got to put this in
a
perspective.
A silver Indian Rapunzel.
I walked in this morning, and Pumi had her hair down, and yes. And I said, and she pointed out, no, actually, this was a.
I had a wardrobe malfunction.
A wardrobe malfunction. So I let my hair down in solidarity with Pumi.
Thank you.
Solidarity forever.
All right, so you two workers of the world uniting.
My goodness.
let's get into the story of Canton's, because that's quite frightening. You would think.
Why
because,
is it frightening?
Well, because very right-wing people, right? Now, there's a difference between right-wing people, and that's already kind of scary to some. But right-wing people, generally conservatives, they might not be right-wing as in the dangerous end of the right-wing, but once you say very right-wing people, you mean people with reactionary views. Remember, this is the scale that we were taught at university anyway. On the extreme left, you've got the radicals. As you move in from the extreme left, you get left-wing people, then you get liberal people, then you get moderates, then you get conservatives, then you get right-wing people, then you get reactionaries. That's the spectrum, right? And usually it's shaped like a horseshoe, so that the reactionaries and the radicals actually end up closer together than the moderates are to either. Makes sense.
Yeah, it kind of sort of does make sense. Gareth,
makes sense.
Yeah, one of the difficulties we've got here right now.
To explain that without fucking it up. Pumi's like, thank you, it does make sense. It feels good to be
Gareth,
acknowledged
you,
for trying.
You're being affirmed, Gareth. That's what's happening. But the significant thing right now is to get down to the definition. You're absolutely right in terms of the spectrum that you just described.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is that because of the fact that everything has just moved so drastically over to the left, that people that would previously be considered to be liberal are now considered to be alt-right.
Mm.
And if you look in terms of where this research can actually be correct. People who tend to be on the conservative end of the spectrum are more likely to be in stable, long-term relationships simply because of the fact that those are generally based on conservative values, such
as marriage,
the institution of marriage, religion often drives it. And within that particular context, your access to a fulfilling sexual relationship is more available.
So you're saying that the term...
There's a sense of duty there to how much sex you're actually going to give your husband.
Right? Well, you know, no, wait a second. You know, I thought there's a sense of duty on the part of the husbands.
Depends on where you are.
So let's just go back to definitions here then. My problem is that, certainly according to your explanation you've just given now, it makes sense that very right-wing might not actually be very right-wing.
Exactly right.
Yeah,
that's my point.
Because very right-wing might just indicate people of conservative bent.
Look, I think a significant portion of the Twitterati out there would say, for example, that you and I are extremely right-wing.
Yeah, which is ludicrous because we both are, certainly to the bit that I know about you, classical liberal, for free speech, for freedom of movement, for people to have whatever sexual orientation they like, for people to be whatever gender they prefer. We don't have a problem with any of that
exactly,
stuff.
Exactly, yeah.
And those used to be quite left-wing values. So,
correct.
Okay. Yes. But we do live in a country, by the way, where it bears saying that most people in South Africa are conservative, actually. So take the politics out of it. Because if we didn't have political parties manipulating us for votes on both the left and the right and in the center, we would think about these things as values. Most people in South Africa are, from a values point of view, quite conservative. They're church-going. They believe in nuclear families. They believe in certain moral and value-based judgments on things. For example, that you shouldn't steal, you shouldn't kill, you shouldn't... All those kind of good old solid religious values, which they incorporate into their life, even if they're secular people.
Yeah.
In terms of the way they behave. They raise their children that way. You know, they think about the world in very much a, this is good, let's keep it where it is view, rather than let's change everything. Is that fair enough?
I think that's fair.
Across the board, black, white, Afrikaans, English, Xhosa, Indian, colored, I think most people in this country are probably more conservative than they are left-wing. And therefore, this is not a surprising study to you. These people are happier?
These people are very much happier. In fact, if you take a look at the graph.
But especially in that survey, you said they have more sex.
Yes, they have more sex.
So what is the graph? Explain it to me quickly.
Well, the graph just basically shows where you are on the political spectrum and where you are and your overall happiness. And that graph is showing a couple of different countries, but as you can see...
So which country there is performing the best?
Performing the best. Well, basically...
In terms of sex that they're getting.
Well, it appears to be Germany and France.
Oh.
Well, though actually they all kind of intersect. Germany, France and Denmark kind of intersect, but Germans are kind of way up there.
So basically what we've learned in the first 5 minutes of the Burning Platform today is that if you're over 40 and you are right wing, you're basically great. Everything's
you're ticking
fantastic.
Everything is awesome.
And everyone
you're
else is miserable.
All the boxes. Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's an interesting way to start the Burning Platform today before we turn our attention to the usual diet of current affairs. Pumi did mention earlier that the news cycle is becoming almost too much to bear now. You know, you hear about a volcano somewhere so far away that, you know, 100 years ago it would have taken a post ship almost a month and a half to get the information to you. Now it's something you worry about because you think, oh my God, what role do we play in this? And global warming, and is this as a result of us abusing the earth for the last 40 years? And all kinds of other things. And I keep being bombarded with charts too, from all kinds of organizations about how this is the hottest year ever. But there are friends of mine in Calgary, for example, where it's colder than the Antarctic right now.
Whoa.
Yeah, and there are places like the Cape, which at the moment is going through a heat wave. Apparently, temperatures could reach something like 45 degrees in the Karoo. What we've got to differentiate between here is climate, which is a much more long-term thing, and weather. And I think a lot of people see the weather as indicative of the overall climate in a much more micro way. than it should be represented.
One of the issues that we've got right now in terms of access to information, because remember that nearly all of the stuff that's coming to us is free.
Mm.
So, you know that old saying that when something is free, you are the product.
Yes.
So essentially what you then need to track back in terms of is who are the people who are pushing those particular bits of information in your direction. And more to the point, what do they stand to gain if you believe that bit of information? And so it's actually a crucial thing that I teach in my journalism classes, that when you're interrogating the source of information, one of the questions that you must always ask, if I believe this, whose interests are being served? And if you consider that the flow of information is actually controlled by very specific lobby groups, really, if you drill down into it, and every one of them has a particular agenda to push. So, you know, obviously the fossil fuels industry has a very good reason to want to push a agenda that actually increases support for fossil fuels.
Sure.
Similarly, people who derive massive amounts of funding really from the green lobby will be the type of people who actually...
And who might want to push legislation.
To push legislation and push that agenda, because again, in both camps, their funding actually depends on it.
Right.
And our ability to then drill down into whose agenda is actually being served, how much of this is actually fact, how much of this is actually spin, and then try and draw an informed opinion. And that's a lot more difficult now than it used to be when I was a kid.
What compounds it is this running, chasing the breaking news, right? So one of the things that a couple of days ago, the story with Old Mutual and Peter Moyo.
Yes,
right? So
and Trevor.
breaking news, the judgments come back. Right. And then almost immediately, everybody, the way that everybody's reporting on the story is that, oh, Old Mutual has won. Right. Old Mutual has won. The judgment has come in that the Peter Moyo and Judge Mashile, who gave the original judgment, don't have to reinstate Peter Moyo. But that's actually not what happened. That's not what the judgment is. The judgment is that they have been granted leave to appeal.
Oh, right.
So
it's misrepresentation for the sake of clickbait and headlines.
But because everybody is chasing the breaking story and because time is so short,
right,
none of those editors, none of those newsrooms took the time to read through the entire judgment and formulate an opinion and put it out.
So what chance do ordinary people have? Because again, according to you and Kanthan Pumi, it appears that we're all now in the position of being an editor for our own news feed, right?
Correct.
And most of us are hugely unqualified for that job, because it requires someone who can take all of that information and triage it effectively and be able to figure out whether or not this is a story.
I see that triage is our word this morning.
Clearly. I mean, it came up this morning and it seems to be a theme today.
Pumi's a trendsetter as always.
I actually got an email to this extent from someone about Bader-Meinhof syndrome.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
In what the context of Bader-Meinhof syndrome with regard to what we're talking about?
Well, just that when, you know, the Bader-Meinhof phenomenon is that once you hear about something, you'll probably start noticing it a whole lot more.
Exactly,
after
yeah.
Now, triaging is our Bader-Meinhof syndrome for this morning.
No, I don't think it works that way. It just so happens that you adopted it based on the fact that it featured prominently in the previous
Being
hour.
Able to filter all of these news stories is very hard.
And but it's also, you know, if you have a job outside of media, you don't have the time.
No,
so
you don't.
You don't have the time to read through this judgment, formulate your own opinion, and then send out stuff. You're just retweeting whatever, you know, various news agencies that you like are tweeting out. And if they're tweeting kind of slightly skewed information, you've just...
That's your worldview.
That's fine.
And of course, for most people, I was talking to someone about this just the other day, most of us don't subscribe to a panoply of different publications, right? We might in our news feed, whether it's on social media or anywhere else, subscribe to a few, but they're usually things that confirm our already entrenched positions. That's how we are as human beings. We have a confirmation bias.
Everyone who reads The Guardian being a case in point.
Well, that's a good case in point, but I do not, and The Guardian doesn't enter my world very often. When it does, it's an object of some ridicule. But for a person who loves that point of view, they probably only subscribe to The Guardian. So they only see a whole different reality to the reality that I see.
Correct, yes. And what's fascinating for me is I follow people from across the political spectrum because of the fact that I want exposure to all of those diverse viewpoints.
Yeah.
And there's a significant chunk of people that I follow who will incessantly retweet articles from The Guardian because of the fact that it actually confirms their point of view.
Right.
You know, similarly, there are other people who will incessantly retweet stuff that comes from Russia Today and from China News Daily, again, because it confirms their particular points of view.
All right, well, let's get into some of these stories because we can't skirt the issue.
Let's start with Russia, please.
Do you want to start with
Russia?
Please,
let's start with Russia.
So, Pumi, go for it. What's happening? What do you know?
Well, what I would...
Fill me in.
Absolutely. First off, the prime minister, you know, Russia's got a prime minister
and
a president.
Yes.
So the prime minister and the cabinet have resigned.
So that's Dmitry Medvedev and all the ministers.
Well, let's just go back. Before we get to the point of resignation, earlier on in the day, Putin gave a significant policy statement where he said, look, we've made significant progress so far in terms of turning the country around, but the time has come for us to put out a referendum on constitutional amendments that will actually strengthen our democracy. And immediately at that point, I said, so Putin is finding a way to make himself president for life.
After 20 years.
Yes, he is taking a leaf directly. In fact, he's taking an entire chapter out of Xi Jinping's book, which, you know, Xi has effectively put himself in that position. He rewrote
president for life.
Yeah. Well, effectively, he can be president for life now, in terms of the rules of engagement. Now, remember that what Putin did. Now Putin took over from Boris Yeltsin back in the day. Now, Boris Yeltsin's claim to fame was that he spent a lot of his time in office absolutely drunk.
That's right.
Yes, and the world was a better place for it, I'd like to think, because, you know, when you're drunk, you don't really have time to plot
schemes and
all of that. But of course, it was a time when the oligarchs actually ran rampant. But anyway, Putin came in, served his mandatory couple of terms, and the rule is that you need to step down at the end of that term. So he stepped down, became prime minister for a term. And I think it was the same guy, Medvedev, who then became president.
Yes.
But Putin was effectively running the country as prime minister. And then at the end of that term, he then stood for election as president again. Now, clearly, he doesn't want to go through that cycle again. He could do that. So he could step down now, become prime minister, but, you know, effectively still running the country. But, you know, clearly he doesn't want to waste time.
We carry on playing this cat and mouse game, where essentially he's president or prime minister for all of us during our lifetimes.
Dude is the last man standing. Well,
you see, a lot of us kind of get upset about this type of thing. Let's draw a direct correlation, for example, with Germany.
Mm-hmm.
There are no term limits in Germany. So Angela Merkel has been leading Germany pretty much for as long as Putin has been leading Russia.
20 years for Putin. He started in May of 2000. He's currently 67 years old.
Yes. So, let's do a direct comparison with
Angela Merkel.
Angela Merkel.
All right.
Let's also do a comparison with the UK, because, again, there's no term limits in terms of UK.
Oh, there are no term limits.
Yeah, you can continue being prime minister pretty much as
Angela
long as
Merkel has been the leader of the centre-right Christian Democratic Union from 2000 as well. It's the same time as Putin. She took over as Kanzler. Chancellor of Germany. When did that happen? Since 2005.
All right.
So just 5 years short of Vladimir Putin, she's been in power.
But 15 years she's been around.
And long time.
Yeah. But what I'm trying to say is that we tend to get quite worked up about the concept of term limits, whereas, you know, term limits don't really matter as much as the democratic processes that are actually underpinning that. So if you have free and fair elections, and the issue in Russia for me is not the term limits, because if you draw a direct comparison between Angela Merkel and Vladimir Putin, the fundamental difference is the transparency that goes into the electoral processes that happen in those countries. And so it's not really about the term limits that I have my issues. It's about the underlying processes. Okay. And we all know that what happens if you're an opposition leader in Russia, it's a shortcut to getting in jail.
Yes. So do we have any clarity on what exactly was proposed in terms of these constitutional changes? And why then the entire cabinet and prime minister resigned? Are they in opposition to what Vlad is trying to do? Or are they just playing his game and dancing according to his tune?
Oh, they're definitely playing his game because Medvedev has immediately been...
new job.
A new job. He's effectively second in command of the... of the party apparatus, yes.
So, in other words, this is play acting,
political survival.
Well, yes, but it's play acting within a particular set of rules. You know, it's kind of like going back to Bill Clinton. I did not have sex with that woman.
All right.
Yeah, but you know, president for life, Putin. I think. Look, he's in extremely good shape for 67.
No, he's not going to go anywhere anytime soon, unless he's, you know, something really unfortunate happens. He's pretty much in the seat for another 20 years.
Well, you say unfortunate. There are many people out there who would probably think the other way around. But of course, you know, ditto in the case of Trump. And
I think that the most interesting thing about Putin is how we actually don't really look at that man as a political master. I mean, he was there when Mikhail Gorbachev went down. You know, he was there and he turned off the lights and then promptly moved across to say, actually, I'm resigning from the KGB. I never believed in this stuff at all. I love the fact that he's such a astute politician.
Machiavellian.
Unbelievable. And also because he looks like he's on a Old Spice commercial.
Yeah, he does. Very much an 80s man. Okay, so let's look now at the stories from closer to home. State capture inquiry heard evidence that former President Jacob Zuma tried to help people linked to his nephew Kulubuse Zuma to get government contracts despite his denials to the contrary. Also, the story of the Gupta landing at Watercliff has been extolled, and we've heard some detail we didn't know before from some of the people who were on the base at the day at the time that the Guptas landed their plane for their wedding. That was really the canary in the coal mine moment, right? That was when we started to hear about just how captured the state was by this family and their political connections.
I don't really think it was the canary in the coal mine moment. I think that actually happened to be the Bader Meinhof moment, because that's when we all started paying attention to the signs that were there all along.
But it had been happening for years before.
It had indeed been happening for years before.
So when this goes down at the state capture inquiry and there is new evidence brought and there are people who've never spoken to the public before who are now giving testimony, and then Jacob Zuma seems to be too ill to attend proceedings, what do we make of this?
Well, I don't know. He did make a trip to Cuba for medical treatment, didn't he?
He did, and then he came back.
Mm. So did they fix him?
But he's supposed to be appearing in the Peter Maritzburg court, and his lawyers have said he cannot appear because he's
too ill.
He's traveling for treatment.
Oh, right. Do we know what's wrong with him?
The thing for me about, and I know we've spoken about it before, how the state capture inquiry is just, it's the sideshow that has stopped anything and anyone from, particularly in the government circles, from operating, from working. So people now have this air of fear. So anybody that does work with government will know that everything has almost ground to a halt, because first of all, it's like Hollywood. Half the positions are filled with actors.
Mm-hmm.
So people are acting this, acting chief, acting CEO, all sorts of things. And the people who are there supposedly working are not signing anything off, because everybody is so afraid that signing anything off will implicate them in a particular way. And they're just like, I don't know. So they would much rather shift paper. I had a particularly interesting experience facilitating with in a state-owned enterprise with a group of senior managers. So kind of executive level, before group executive, executive level, about 200 individuals. And the air of fear is hanging over everybody's head. And there's a lady who, kudos to her, was able to stand up and say, you know, I've just sent a text to my husband to say I'm going to be brutally honest in this session. And if I get fired, so she pulled a if I die, I die moment and said, I will tell you now that nobody wants to. I, for one, am here every day. I show up for work, but I don't sign off anything because I don't have power to sign off. And those things that do land in front of my desk that I need to sign off, I will rather hand over to someone senior to me to sign off, because I do not know what I sign off, and things arrive and they've been through a channel. And because I'm in an acting position, I have no idea what the back end of that is.
Yeah.
People have been suspended for all sorts of wrongdoing and then come back and there's no explanation as to what is. And what that has created is it's created, even as Cyril Ramaphosa says, we're trying to fix and all of that. The people on the ground who are supposed to be doing the work, because of what's happening in Parktown, I just wait in a wait and see game. But nobody wants to sign anything.
But with
off.
All the love in the world, those people should then just be gotten rid of, because they're a drain on the taxpayer. They're a drain on resources. They're not, as you say, they're not doing anything. So they're not productive or efficient or effective. And even if they are in an acting position, we should just have them canned. They should
by
be
whom?
Fired.
Fired by whom?
This is the problem, is we have no leadership. We need someone to go in there and say, guys, sorry you've been sitting here waiting for this, but it proves that we don't need you in the long run anyway. Out. Fire. Clean it out. The bureaucracy needs to be denuded.
So
two-thirds of them must go.
Clean it out, and leadership. So, Canthan, are you going to explain to everybody why Male Khaburu Mkhoba is such a bad decision for our young President Cupcake in that Eskom position? Because, as you know, so then making all the right noises, I've got a new CEO, get rid of all these people, get rid of, and then we put in new people, and who is the new blood that he's brought in? Ta-ta-da-dan! Go for you it. Know,
I just basically give a deep sigh. The important thing for me is that he happens to be an interim chairperson. So I think that that's a crucial thing for us to consider. It's someone that has been brought in on a stopgap basis.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it's true that he knows nothing about the business of Eskom, but the
but
fact
then that
is
wouldn't that make him different to any other previous chair.
Correct. And at the same time, take the view that, well, he did run UKZN. Admittedly, during his tenure, you know, UKZN hemorrhaged cash, and there were all sorts of, allegations of maladministration and so forth. But, you know, at least he wasn't corrupt. So I think it's the best that we can actually look for at this point. You have someone who's basically an interim board chairperson, you know, who's there basically because, you know.
I'm pleased to hear that there are people who are afraid. Because they should be afraid. There are people who've been siphoning off money and stealing from the Treasury for the last 20 years who should be afraid. And some of these people should go to jail. We should make them more afraid, not less.
Except for the fact that you then have an entire administration that has ground to a halt. So you have police stations with no rape kits.
How's that different to when things work?
So you have police stations with no rape kits.
And a lot of women who've been in the situation where they've had to report a rape will tell you that that's always been the case. So no, actually, all this is proving is we don't need this government.
I don't know. I think that we're in a, you know, so we're in a...
Pumi, this is time for your kumbaya moment when you say we as South Africans must pull together and take responsibility for our lives. And
dude, and say that Cyril will not make it to the end of his term.
Well, then what do we have to look forward to? Didi Mabuza.
Well, let's talk about some interesting stuff that's been happening in the past.
A lot of people in the ANC are talking about this. I saw that the veterans, all these old men and women who still hold to some long dead ideology, which is professed by crooks in the hope of cleansing their own souls. You see these veterans come out yesterday, like, hands off Cyril and Tito. But if we get rid of Cyril and Tito, then what do we have to look forward to? What's next? What exciting things will the ANC deliver on a silver platter next? Anybody? Didn't think so.
This is the moment where you play the crickets.
Yeah, because there isn't a plan.
The sound.
So we've got a disgruntled state captured lot who are just angry with Cyril because he's not following the old party line. What do we have if he goes? Tito's talking like someone who's very right wing, according to the modern definition, rather than the actual
Except
definition.
Tito has been given a smackdown by the ANC.
I saw that about the reserve bank.
Yes.
So what do we make of that?
Yeah, let's
who's really in charge here?
Let's just talk about the Reserve Bank thing for a second, because that was, you know, one of the questions that a couple of people asked. You know, I put out a call on Twitter for people to for stuff for us to talk about, and someone said, "Can you cover ANC's obsession with the Reserve Bank?" And my logic around this, we've spoken about that on this show previously, the whole idea around the purported nationalization of the Reserve Bank, even though, remember that the South African government is the majority shareholder.
Yes, of course.
Yeah, and the whole idea really is to get hold of the private shareholders because that then removes independent oversight in terms of the Reserve Bank, which basically then gives them the ability to
print money.
Well, not print money, because the printing of money is still controlled by the Constitution, and you know, one can actually go to court and stop the Reserve Bank from printing money, because
a relief.
Yeah. But remember that the issuing of banking licenses, as in what went down with VBS, is VBS was clearly not a case of the issuing of the licenses being on the basis of corruption. But if the oversight over issuing of banking licenses is removed, it then allows anyone pretty much to set up a bank. So you could do a thing like a state bank, for example, which the ANC has been pushing for. We know that the idea of a state bank is fundamentally flawed because they don't have the ability to manage money properly. Remember that the way in which our banking system works is that all of the commercial banks borrow money from the Reserve Bank.
Mm-hmm.
So when you have an entity that is a state bank or a VBS that is able to borrow money from the Reserve Bank and then not manage that money in a responsible fashion, that's the gateway to corruption. So essentially, if you want to track back to the obsession with nationalizing the Reserve Bank, it's that.
Hungry people are looking for a tap they can open.
Yes.
Greedy, corrupt crooks.
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So anyone who's calling for the Reserve Bank to be nationalized, you could pretty much bet your bottom dollar they are the sort of people who can't make money in the real world and are looking for a way to steal yours.
Yes.
Done. Thank you for the explanation. I see Kaius Tolle, who's been on the show a number of times. He's one of our friends and also one of the people who's commented most vociferously on various subjects during the burning platform. Kais Tolle this morning says he bumped into Qaidani Mahlangu in Melrose.
Wow.
Yeah, and there were no bodyguards or conscience to be found.
Ouch.
Ouch. I thought that would be an interesting thing to
add. There is a blast from the past. We haven't seen or heard from her. What since life is it demeaning?
Right, and that's probably the reason she should be quiet. Although I still think there should be criminal charges instituted there. It seems to me that there are people who are dead, whose families have still not satisfactorily been given an explanation for how come their relatives are dead. The most vulnerable people in society, let's not forget, and over 140 of them who died at the hands of Qaidani Mahlangu. That's an egregious and revolting scar on South Africa, post-apartheid South Africa, and zero accountability, zero responsibility.
Well, they took away her bodyguards. Come on, what more do you want?
She's shopping in Melrose. This is outrageous. This woman should be in jail. And the fact that she's walking around and that there are people buried under the ground now as a result of her inaction or her deliberate action, depending on which line you take, but either way, it falls fairly and squarely at her feet. It's outrageous that this woman is allowed to carry on with her life as if nothing happened. Nothing. You try not paying your electricity bill. Guess what happens to you? They come and cut you off. You try not paying someone. Guess what? They sue you. There are various things in life that are consequential. Not if you're in government. It's absolutely no consequence at all. Drives me crazy. This is probably one of the most infuriating stories. It's never gone away for me. I'm still annoyed by it. Let's just look at Kulubuse and this whole thing, because, you know, he also sort of disappeared for a little while. There were even rumors that he died because he's morbidly obese. And he probably hasn't got long in this world anyway. But Brent Simon, spokesperson for the late minister Collins Chabane, was testifying before Raymond Zondo. Simon said he saw Zuma introduce Chabane to several young men whom he later learned were being partly funded by Kulubuse. This again, to show you the spirit of Ubuntu in the Zuma family. Kulubuse is the man who did not pay any of his miners. He had to be taken to court several times to pay them, and to this day they have not been paid. He liquidated company after company so that he could avoid personal responsibility. He has not spent a cent on trying to help the people who he was meant to have paid. These are people who already had worked for him in a now defunct mine which was mismanaged into the ground. No sense of consequence. Again, no personal responsibility. And this fat, revolting man of absolutely no skill, no talent, and no ability, just because of his connection to the then president, is sitting outside of the world of responsibility with no one he has to account to himself for. Unbelievable. While other people are starving, hungry, unemployed, and desperate. The very people he hired. Lots of Ubuntu going around here. It's driving me mad. Am I the only one?
No, I think that there's just a sense of resignation on the part of our fellow South Africans with regard to this stuff.
Did I get any of the facts wrong?
Not as far as I'm aware.
So how could this even be an issue for some people to prevaricate on?
Because facts don't matter anymore, Gareth. Have you not been following what's been happening in the world?
Oh, my God. It's going to drive me mad.
Can we talk about Peter Moyo?
Please, let's. Pumi brought up the Peter Moyo and Trevor Manuel, the whole case with
the ongoing saga.
Yes. So let's talk.
Although on the news of the judgment on Monday, was the judgment on Tuesday, the share price, we'll all be glad to know, the share price has rallied.
Okay.
A little bit is coming up because it's been suffering. I mean, this whole fight between
you're talking
Peter
about Old Mutual's share price.
Yeah.
Why would it have rallied? Is just certainty? End to the drama in some ways?
Well, it's not an end. It's just a pause because now we're, you know, off to Bloemfontein.
What did you want to say about
the appeal?
About Peter Moyo.
Well, I just wanted to point out that I had said on this show that eventually Peter Moyo would end up losing it. And that really what was going on was really a negotiation in terms of the
severance package.
The severance package, yes.
And that's what you think is happening.
Well, that's, yeah. But except I think based on this current judgment, I think that a particular window of opportunity has now been closed. So in fact, the time for settlement would have come just before this one. So he's indicated that he's going to take it on appeal. The question then becomes whether a higher court after, was this a full bench that actually heard this one? I think it was.
Yeah, so that's why Bloemfontein is his next stop.
Yes, so Bloemfontein will be his next stop. But
it's nice to be one of these super elite people in this country who can afford to go all the way to the Supreme Court of Appeal. And a big multinational corporation, or in this case, national corporation like Old Mutual, who can afford the other side. It's nice for them.
But you know, the thing for me is we're seeing, I mean, boardroom fights like this happen all the time. Boards and directors and CEOs have these fights all the time. But they don't spill out into the public arena or into the court arena the way that this has. And one of the things that I truly believe the reason it's gotten this far is because Trevor Manuel is a politician.
Yeah.
And this is how politicians deal with things. You know, they're like wrecking balls. And they're happy to have the court of public opinion play out. Unfortunately for Old Mutual and pension funds, people who are invested, right. are the ones that are suffering.
And they're because the ones who are paying for this, too.
This is a conversation that needed to be had in the boardroom. This is a conversation that needed to be fought out in the boardroom. Yeah, we didn't need to get this up, but Trevor Manuel, politicians.
Pumi, you're allowing your prejudices to get in the way of the facts around this entire issue. And just remember that the reason why this entire debacle started in the first place is not because Trevor Manuel is a politician. And, you know, certainly he's a politician. But remember that essentially Peter Moyo was accused of pocketing dividends worth 30 million rand linked to an investment holding company that...
Jesus, there's just greed everywhere. Unbelievable.
Yeah, which is partly... So, in other words, Moyo owns the company. Moyo is chief executive of Old Mutual, purportedly then pays this company, which then pays him a dividend. And of course, the counterpoint is that this takes place with the knowledge of the Old Mutual board, because the Old Mutual board is a 20% shareholder in the subsidiary company that Peter Moyo is part of. So, but the entire thing, does it actually fall foul of corporate governance? Absolutely.
Well, this is what drives me mad. Mm. How can we have this kind of scavenging at the highest ranks of our big companies? And it's scavenging, which I think they've largely learnt from the politicians. You have a backdoor.
No, I don't think so. The scavenging has always been there, because what you try and do is exploit loopholes at a number of levels. But the whole idea is that there is supposed to be oversight. These are supposed to be arm's length transactions.
But hold on, this is a listed company.
Yes,
you are not running your own little spaza shop here, where you can have your cousin do the cashing up every day and they get to keep a certain percentage and they funnel the rest back to you. It's not a spaza shop. It's a publicly listed company. There are rules.
Yes, and ultimately what happens is that those rules then get implemented by the shareholders. And the shareholders in this particular case were very clear about the fact that they were unhappy with this entire chains of transactions.
So whose side are you on and whose side are you on, Pumi?
Well, I'm on the side of the shareholders fundamentally, because it is a private company, but ultimately private companies are private companies. So they're not accountable to anyone other than their shareholders.
Yeah.
In terms of the grand scheme of things.
Whose side are you on, Pumi?
Dude, I am totally on the side of shareholders and people whose pension funds are being mismanaged by this entire like shit show. Mm. Because this fight is going to go on for a while. They're going to be going on at this where they could, we spoke about this last week,
settle and
find a way to work it out. Work it out without it having to have this impact. But Gareth, I want to say, you know, the thing about, we have this idea that corporate South Africa has some kind of governance that doesn't exist in the public sector, or that they have a better grapple with corporate governance, but they don't. We see Steinhoff being the most extreme version of it. But yesterday, ShopRite has been fined R1 million for reckless lending. Now, all of that, you see the share price of Capitec doing a huge run, absolutely crazy kind of. And when you look at that for the shareholders, it looks like a great thing, because the price of the share is so much higher than where they bought at. But at the same time, you see all their major directors selling out on their shares, and nobody is kind of going, what's going on here? If the share price is doing so
directors selling their shares, remember, is very firmly controlled in terms of the rules of engagement of the JSE. And that's the kind of stuff where the window of opportunity for you to be able to sell shares is very tightly policed. Now, if you look in terms of the institutional investors that...
Otherwise, you get locked up for insider trading.
Yes, exactly. But now the institutional investors who actually own massive chunks of Old Mutual, Alan Gray, for example, is one of the biggest institutional shareholders. So, Pumi, going back to your point in terms of the pensioners who are suffering, no, it's rubbish. Because, in fact, if you take a look at Alan Gray as a very specific example, Alan Gray has consistently outperformed the market. So, in fact, if you've had your pension fund sitting with Alan Gray, you've actually been sitting pretty. So the knock-on effect in terms of that is not the same as, say, the PIC. where you know, the PIC has in, overall its investments have underperformed
because it's a balanced portfolio.
So yeah, so if you take a look at Old Mutual shareholders, I'm just taking a quick look. So so Old Mutual believes that the board, as shareholder representative, should be able to dismiss CEOs without need for cash settlements. Hmm. So, you know, as a very specific example, All Weather Capital, which has 10 billion assets under management, said they were happy to pay a 250 million settlement just because that would then get in, because 250 million was the amount of money that clearly was under negotiation.
Jesus, that's a lot of money. That's a lot of money. How do I get into a role where I can get a settlement at 250
Prudential
million?
Investment.
I mean, I'd settle for half of that. I'd settle for 20th of that if I were him.
Prudential Investment Managers owns 4% of Old Mutual. They're also in favor of an out-of-court settlement, but say 250 million is too high. So all of that, so those are all of the bits and pieces. But generally, the institutional investors were supportive of Manuel's action. Mm. So, you know, so essentially the idea, Pumi, is whether you actually pay out 250 million just simply to quell outrage or whether you actually stick to your principles. And in this particular case, you see, the big issue in terms of Old Mutual is that its market cap took a knock as a director. So its share price dropped. But remember that the share price is likely to rebound at the point at which the matter eventually
gets settled. They figure out what's going on.
Yeah, well, you know, so if you consider what happened at the point at which the Iran crisis started off, we immediately saw the markets taking a dive, the price of oil went up.
Oil,
and then suddenly when, you know, everything goes back to an overall state of normality, then everything corrects and gets back into
well, it's exactly where it was now. The oil price has come back down to where it was before this crisis. Just two things I want to ask you guys about quickly. We haven't got a lot of time left. First one, to go to America quickly, the Democrats had another debate this week, and Bernie and Elizabeth Warren have turned on each other, which was inevitable. It was a Trotsky-Stalin situation.
Well, Elizabeth Warren basically...
She made up a story about how Bernie... Well, this is according to Bernie, and I'm willing to be a little bit less cruel to Bernie than I usually would be, because he is consistent. And for the last 40 years, Bernie has been a massive supporter of intersectional politics, of feminism, of equal opportunities, of very left-wing policy. You can accuse Bernie of lots of things, but he has been a non-stop supporter of those kinds of policies. He supposedly said to Elizabeth Warren 2 years ago when they met in New York, "I don't think a woman could win against Donald Trump," right?
Mm-hmm.
And she took this to mean he doesn't think a woman could win. She shut up about this for the longest time, and suddenly her people leaked this week that Bernie is now the arch anti-feminist and that he said something which is just totally against all left-wing politics, and he's basically anti-women. This is what she put out there. So CNN, in a very dishonest exchange, said, Bernie Sanders, this is Wolf Blitzer. Wolf Blitzer says to him, "Bernie, you apparently said to Elizabeth Warren you didn't think that a woman could win." Bernie says, "I did not say that. I categorically deny I said that." Wolf Blitzer turns straight to Elizabeth Warren and says, "So, when Bernie Sanders said to you that he doesn't think a woman could be president," completely ignoring Bernie's answer, "what did you say to him?" And she goes, "I disagreed." Mm-hmm. This is very dishonest. This is horrible stuff.
What I'm really more concerned about, Gareth, is that you're expecting honesty from these politicians. Are you okay this morning?
But it's happening on TV in front of us. We're watching a lie being told by the mainstream media and Elizabeth Warren's camp. And
Exhibit A, I did not have sex with that woman.
Yeah, but I'm sorry.
Why do we keep
revisiting this? Here's someone who's politically opposed to very many of the things that I would agree with, right? And he is being eaten by this fact-free, feeling-full world. What the hell? You see it happen in front of your very eyes. We can't pick this apart. The smoke and mirrors have been taken out of the room. Am I wrong? We're watching them stitch up Bernie Sanders again. I have no love for Bernie Sanders. This Elizabeth Warren is a duplicitous bitch. Someone's got to say it.
Have you got that off your chest?
I mean,
you got that off your chest.
Is there no honesty?
Because politicians
None.
Will politic.
Not even a little bit of honesty. It would go a long way. Tell you what, if the Democrats want to have any one of these people succeed, we need a little more authenticity and a little less lying, please. I think they would. They're up against Donald Trump, one of the most unpopular people of all time.
Actually, I think that Donald Trump is going to increase his...
I agree with you, but this is because these people, they dig themselves a hole and then they keep on digging. The Democrats. Do me a favor. It's outrageous. And there's still people who think, oh no, Elizabeth Warren would be a great candidate.
Mm.
In what universe? And then the last thing I want to ask you about. Thanks for your help on that one, you two.
No, Gareth, you know,
Gareth, you just wanted an opportunity to vent about Elizabeth Warren.
I wanted to. I hoped that there would be some kind of argument that I could take seriously.
No, you know, Gareth, one of the most fantastic things about media today is sometimes you have to take the opportunity to shut up. So we are giving you the opportunity. Kenton and I are taking the opportunity to shut up.
All right. One last thing I want to ask you about. Young people across the Western world are on track to become the first generation to grow up poorer than their parents. Mm. So how are millennials in just one country bucking this trend? It's old news that university debts and rocketing housing costs are among the concerns for people born between the 1980s and 2000s, living particularly in the US and UK, and many other countries. Multiple studies suggest this group will be the first to end up poorer than the parents. However, Norway seems to be doing something differently. Best known for the Viking history, snow sports, and jaw-dropping fjords, Norway is making a new name for itself as the only major economy where young people are getting markedly richer. So, how do they do it? Young Norwegians have enjoyed a 13% rise in disposable household income compared to Generation X. These startling figures come from the largest comparative wealth data set in the world, the Luxembourg Income Database. Apparently, it's partly a lucky situation. They don't think about how they spend their money. They go to the theater. They go to the cinema. They're pursuing careers in writing, in all kinds of interesting things. I'm aware of how lucky the situation is. His hourly pay starts at 164 Norwegian kroner, increasing for weekend and evening shifts. Further down the road is a 31-year-old business analyst who is packing his BMW with supplies for a barbecue. What is Norway doing differently? A huge part of their fantastic lifestyle is down to the country's rapid economic growth. After seeing the biggest increase in average earnings of any large high-income economy between 1980 and 2013, it now leads multiple global rankings for wealth and well-being. It also came out top of the 2017 Lagartem Prosperity Index, which analyzes countries from all over the world. Their huge oil and gas sector is clearly the driving factor behind this. And they also say that it is not just how much money Norwegians make that makes it significant, but what they do with that money. They've managed their oil money and their savings well, using a portion of that to put back into society. So what do we make of Norway?
Norway has a sovereign wealth fund.
Yes.
And essentially what that means is that if you look in terms of the sovereign wealth fund, no one in Norway ever needs to work ever again.
And that's because they've got all this oil.
Oil and gas?
No, it's because of the fact that they invested it accordingly. It's not dissimilar to, on a smaller scale, the reason why Botswana is relatively prosperous. Because essentially what happened in the case of Botswana is that successive governments basically handed over management of the diamond wealth to De Beers and then plowed the money back into uplifting people as a whole. So that money then went into education, that money then went into providing basic services and that kind of stuff. And if you actually get to the point where you're successfully investing your country's wealth, and then a lot of the wealth then gets generated from your investments that are then outside the country. So if you're invested on the New York Stock Exchange as a country and that money then flows back into your coffers, then you're in a very comfortable situation.
Wasn't there a stage where the ANC were proposing that we should have a sovereign wealth fund?
Yes, but before we get to the point of having a sovereign wealth fund, we need to be at a point where we're not incurring debt.
Oh, that.
Yes.
How irritating, this debt.
Someone just asked a question. Scottish independence, is it a tired old drum or a valid point post-Brexit? There was a saying back in the 1800s, which the Americans knew about because, you know, it was the time when the UK was, Britain was really trying to shut off the flow of technology going across to the United States to try and prevent them turning into the burgeoning economy that it is right now.
Yeah.
And there was a Scottish saying that said, when the English are being fleeced, the Scots like to hold the shears.
So what is going to happen? Because I saw Boris had sent a letter to Nicole Sturgeon saying there's no space for us to discuss Scottish independence.
What's going to happen is that there's not going to be a referendum. Another Scottish independence referendum.
You think so?
There's not going to be a referendum. Yeah, it's done for now, and frankly, I think that what's going to happen is that people are going to sit out this next period to see to what extent Bojo is actually able to deliver, and that's then going to determine whether people actually end up voting for an independent Scotland.
Hmm. All right, very good.
Before we say goodbye,
yes.
Before you go, Gareth, and
Pums.
We listen to Babies Behind Bars.
Mm-hmm.
Quick update, because Davy Scholes, you know,
yes,
my favorite
person. Yes, of course, your favorite election guy.
My favorite by-election guy and the trends, Schweizer Rennecker, right, had a by-election.
Most famous for that woman who put a picture of her beaver on the internet for everyone, or whose friend did from the WhatsApp group, the hockey WhatsApp group. Yes. Yes.
Two big conclusions, he says. The DA replicated its disastrous 2019 performance with Afrikaans voters.
Yes.
And the EFF is growing with black voters. Hmm. Right? Guess what? DA. So ANC, EFF, FF, DA in
so
that order.
Very important there that the Vryheidsfront Plus have basically displaced the DA in third place. Hmm. EFF growing. Well, there we go. That's what happens when you're in turmoil.
And that was in the majority Afrikaans ward, and mm-hmm. in the majority black ward, ANC, EFF, DA.
Wow. All right. Very interesting. 8 o'clock. Thank you, everybody. Coming up next, Babies Behind Bars. CliffCentral.com.